number 11B.
So we can sense somehow that if we are still within ourselves and ponder really those very simple points, that little by little the concept enlarges itself and becomes more definite, and it takes on better identity, clearer identity, becomes it crystallizes within our consciousness, and so it we get a warm and great and sense of this truth and love bringing about the Christ idea. When we come to the third part again, truth and love have a different office, where we see in Christianity, which is at the point of seeing the fourth dimension of spirit, where we see that there is only a realm of idea that is really building up the universe, and that the universe is not the universe of matter, but the universe of love's own ideas. Then we begin to see from the point of view of truth that truth has there a different office than before, namely that it is that truth which says, I resolve every concept of error, which because it has no room within the realm of ideas. So that ideas take care of all the beliefs in error, of the fundamental beliefs in error, and wipe them away. They don't destroy them, they resolve them, because they never were something, and we cannot destroy nothingness. We can only see that nothingness resolves itself to be seen as nothingness, which establishes the somethingness of something. So that's why we have there in that part of truth a very wonderful sense that Jesus was demonstrating really the realm of spiritual ideas without having to destroy error, to knock down error, but just to resolve it, just to see that there are beliefs that have no foundation, that therefore they are beliefs as a counterfeit of the glory of God, and that nothing else is going on but the glory of God, which then leads at once into the aspect of love in that third part, where then Jesus shows at the Last Supper really the glory of that love, shows that that love really then unites the whole world into one, so that we have the holistic sense of the world, just that what comes up in the other sciences since about the last 20, 30 years, the sense that there is only one universe, a holistic universe, just like the Gaia theory, which we have considered, that it's a theory which sees that everything is one, that there are not many different layers that fight each other, but there are only many different aspects of the one. It shows really also that holistic sense, that wonderful sense of the anthropic principle, that everything is really working for the glory of bringing out man as God's own spiritual idea. So we see these declarations here, or these statements here, are very up to date. They are timely today. They really refer to what Jesus at the Last Supper was depicting as a great vision to the students. And we come to the fourth part, and there again we think about that divine principle always operating, always being omni-active, and we think, yes, why is principle always operative? Why is the omni-action of principle so effective? Because from the point of view of truth, we begin to see that truth is that which is scientific. Here we have truth as a scientific sense. Therefore, in a science, The science never makes mistakes. In a science, all the solutions are calculated correctly. It maintains really the science of the principle. And so we feel truth is truth. Whatever happens, truth is truth, nothing but the truth. And so nothing can happen really to the creation of that divine principle, so that it maintains always itself intact. That truth is that which says to principle, principle, you are that which maintains yourself constantly intact and therefore maintains also your creation, man and the universe, always intact. And love there shows, therefore, nothing can ever happen to the promise that was set out in the world, the promise that the Christ idea will fulfill everything. And so here we see the consummation of that whole life work of Jesus, the fulfillment of the purpose, why Jesus had to come, why the Jesus asked the Christ had to come, to show that there is no death, and proved it to the utmost. So that within ourselves we have the assurance which is so necessary if one is awake. Actually, those who dream away the days all lifelong, for them it's not so important, but for those who feel that life has a purpose, that each individual has an individual purpose, has an individual message, has an individual mission, for those it is wonderful to know the law that reigns here, which says that which God has foreseen right from the beginning, right from the point where mind was the creator at the beginning of the gospel, that which mind had purpose to fulfill is going to fulfill it to the point of absolute consummation. So that it gives to us that assurance that we are not living in vain, that we are not following our mission, which we feel is our mission, is a God-given mission, that mission will not be in vain. This is a very big point, because you know from history, I guess, that is a very common belief, that people who have really done a big job in their lifetime, that towards the end they always doubt if they have really done a big job. Man can hardly understand these people. Even the medical people make that that observation. I read a book of a medical man, a well-known medical man, who was dealing with this subject, and he said it is quite astonishing to see that when people come towards the end of their human life and have really done a big job in their human life, they begin to doubt if they are really successful, if their life was really worthwhile anything. This is a great attack, really the last attack, so to say, on our life, to say your life was in vain. And so we have to use our science to counteract this belief and see, no, that which mind has willed to do, has brought forth and has launched forth into creation, that mind finds finally its fulfillment, and it cannot fail. It cannot go halfway and then stop. That it goes right through the 7 days up to the point of absolute fulfillment. And we have to see that we acknowledge to ourselves, which is not very easy to do, I must say, it's not very easy to do, to acknowledge that the impulsion of the creative mind has really fulfilled the mission that was destined for the individual. And that mission is for every individual a different one, and that is also shown at the end, really, of the gospel, that Peter and John had two very different life missions, and they cannot be compared, they cannot be imitated. Each one has to fulfill that for which the divine mind has brought forth the idea. Yes. So I have given you the spiritual rhythm of the four with the two, and I think it's really wonderful to take time. Take your time, don't rush. Take your time to go over it again and again. Not that you make notes of it, because if you make notes of it as you go through, you are already confining your further development, because notes, so to say, fix something, and therefore are limitations of the momentary inspiration. Let every day, every time you go through it, let the knowledge, the tonality of what you know about the four and the two flow easily, flow in a new way, flow in an inspirational way, and little by little it takes form, little by little it sinks into our consciousness and becomes us. It becomes, we incorporate then really that rhythm of the spirit. Then this view lets open quite a lot of questions. And that's all right. We don't think that we always have to answer every little detail right at the beginning. Because if we try that, then we fall back to the linear thinking, we fall back to an unstructured consciousness, where we just start out with a little thing and then we try to see that this little thing from every angle and so on, and lose sight of the big picture. But when a layer has been absorbed or made one's own to a certain extent, then quite naturally the thought comes up about saying, yes, this is a wonderful statement, but what does it mean? Again, statement followed by explanation. And so we have gone on yesterday and seen that these eight underlined epitomes, which I have gone through right now, that these underlined epitomes are statements, and we want to see more about the meaning of it. So we started out with the underlined epitomes in the first part and have seen that, the non-underlined epitome are always an explanation of the underlined epitome, because they are a further ramification of it. You see, you have to see that they are not just epitomes, but they are coined, or that they are molded by the underlined epitome. Now, we started out with that very first one, which I felt is a very important one, or the most important one. Namely, we have that as a underlined epitome, that truth reveals the Son of God as a divine infinite calculus. So truth reveals. It reveals what? It reveals the Christ idea of that came. And it reveals it because not only adapted to the 5,000-year period, because John is always looking into the future and therefore already begins to define that Christ idea for the future, because he knew that he will send a new paraclete, a new comforter, which will teach you all things. So he already began to see the science of this Christ idea, and therefore presents the identity of that Christ idea through mind, spirit, and soul, as we have seen, as a divine infinite calculus. When it comes to soul, as identifying the Christ idea, you remember he gives the fourfold statement, which is imbued totally with the sense of the Holy Ghost. The Spirit that descends from heaven rests on the Christ idea, stays there, and brings forth the baptism of the Holy Ghost, of divine science, and of the development of eternal life, truth, and love. So we get there already a more definite sense of this truth revealing itself as the Son of God. If we just say, well, truth reveals to us the Son of God, we just don't have any clear concept what that Son of God is. What we will have will be our mystical sense what the Son of God is, because we have never seen a Son of God. And the Jews said, no, there is no Son of God. And so we have a religious sense, an indefinite sense of the Son of God. We have a sense, well, it's very warm and it's very cozy and it's comforting. But it's ignorance. It's an ignorant state of the Son of God. So this ignorant state has to be explained. So the underlined epitomes explain now what that Son of God is. And this we did yesterday through mind, because it shows, well, that Son of God is not the son of parents. That Son of God is the son of the parent mind, of the divine parent mind, mind capitalized. That is the creator. That is that which has brought forth really the consciousness of man, the divine consciousness of man. So that we ourselves always go back and see that we are really brought forth by that divine mind. That divine mind only brings forth one son, the only begotten son. That God has only one Christ. That there are not many Christs, or Christs many, nor even an antichrist, but that it is the only begotten son. Therefore, that we see that we have to give birth really to that one son, that son which is the Christ idea. That's our sonhood. That's the Christ man. And it's only one Christ man, because one God can only have one Christ. So we drop that sense of that there are many men, that there are many people. We lose the people universe and see that the real man is that Christ consciousness. What is that Christ consciousness? What is the form of it? What is the definition of it? And soul is always that which defines now clearly what that Son of Man is. And as we have seen, it's a fourfold calculus. So we have got through those subtones already quite a good sense, quite a definite sense of what the Son of God is. And so it's taking us out of a mystical sense that there is a Christ and the Son of God, and gives us a scientific description and scientific definition of the Son of God. Then we went further and have seen the moment we get that sense that the Christ is a calculus, then we come to the point of love. From the point of view of love, we have seen here as an underlined epitome that love fulfills really where in us, because it has been born of the Father, so that Christ then is in us, so that love fulfills in us really the divine calculus, so that the divine calculus begins to operate. See, up to that point of mind, spirit, soul, the Christ didn't operate. It was showing how truth revealed it first. Once it had been revealed, it begins to fulfill itself or to operate by itself. And so we had principle, life, truth, and love from the point of view of love, showing that Jesus was not operating his universe, but that the divine principle was operating the universe for Jesus. At the point of principle, we have seen that he didn't go around the country finding out who is ready for for helping him, but just the other way around. There he was coming, standing there, and the disciples went to him. The disciples went to other disciples and said, look here, we have found the Christ, come along. So you see, the disciples also were working for the divine principle and saying, come along too, we have found the Messiah, and they came to Jesus. So it shows that if we have that consciousness of the divine calculus as being our identity, that it begins to work as a principle which attracts those that need to be attracted and separates from those that are in our way, that are not necessary, so that out of those many people in Jerusalem or in Israel, only a few were attracted and a few were necessary in order for Jesus to fulfill his destiny. So it's a wonderful sense. John Dolly always said, well, science purifies. We don't have to purify a situation, but science is something that purifies a situation, no matter if we like it or if we don't like it. That's a beautiful thing. Then he showed at the point of life that this attitude of the calculus is working by itself. Namely, it lifts up the days of creation, thought, to the point of the numerals of infinity. It lifts up the water sense to the inspirational sense of ideas flowing in. Thoughts are thoughts that we produce, that we go along with thoughts and we think about things. These are the days of creation. And Jesus said to the other, said, fill those water pots, six water pots, six to the point of the sixth day of creation. Think out what are the 7 days of creation. Think out what are the 6 days of creation. And if you come to the 6 days of creation, then you get at peace and at rest. Then the water turns, what Mrs. Eddy says, in the seventh day, then the days of creation turn into the numerals of infinity. And they accept the divine infinite calculus. So Jesus didn't turn water into wine, but his consciousness operated the way that the water was turned into wine. He didn't fill the water pots. The others filled the water pots. But he gave them really the method how to do it. Then we more or less stopped at the point of truth, where we see the cleansing of the temple, where we see that Jesus was cleansing of the temple because they made the temple a house of merchandise. They tried to turn the spiritual back into matter. What did he do? He said, no, that can't be done. That must be cleansed. And there it seems that Jesus was actually intervening. But when one reads that whole passage, one can see that Jesus played a very little part in it. Namely, it is so that I found it out somewhere. Gosh, mine. Yeah. So he made a scourge of small cords. There where we stopped yesterday, where I didn't find the true words. The scourge of small cords. Well, he really did what? He did take isolated ideas, cords, and so to say, wove them together, as Mrs. Eddy says, into one web of consistency. See, what did he do it? He really used the divine infinite calculus. In a divine infinite calculus, we do not have isolated cords. We do not have isolated ideas. We can only see that these ideas have really power to handle evil when we see them operating, woven together into one web of consistency, where each idea finds its right place within the whole system, within the whole calculus. And therefore only the calculus has power. Individual ideas have no power. Only when they are woven together into a one web of consistency, they have power. Well, Jesus' consciousness was really at that point where not only did he lift up the water sense into the wine sense, but also he took those wine sense, those chords, those ideas, and put them together into one web of consistency. And that alone had the power to cleanse the temple. It was really what is said there, that it was a seal. His seal was taken over, and seal is defined in Mrs. Eddy's glossary as the reflected animation of life, truth, and love. So really what he did, he let the seal operate. He let actually the animation of life, truth, and love operate for him. And that looked as if he would cast out the money changers out of the temple and cleansing the temple. But actually it was not him, it was the system, the scourge, that was showing a symbol of the divine infinite calculus, that was actually operating as the seal of the Lord, as the animation of life, truth, and love. So again, we can see how the consciousness of Jesus as a calculus was operating here at truth, operating as that which deals with an erroneous concept. And then finally, we saw love, which is only a few verses, but which showed that in love, really, the whole world came to him because of the wonders they saw and wanted to follow him. And many believed because of the miracles. That's interesting. They didn't believe him because of his understanding. They believed him because of the miracles. And so it was also at the beginning of Christian Science. Christian Science could only take hold in the world through the healings. That was the thing that attracted people. It wasn't, so to say, the science that was discovered in the Christian Science textbook that attracted people. It was, first of all, the healing. And it's interesting to see that the only time Mrs. Eddy uses the term induction instead of deduction was that she says that Christian Science is very often accepted by induction. Induction meant that they could reason from the healings back to something which is good. They could see the miracles, and therefore they would say, this is a wonderful effect, so the cause must be good too, and so we're interested in the textbook. But he saw that this is dangerous, that if people really follow Christian Science only because of the bread and fishes, because only of the miracles, that is not too good. And so Jesus left them because he knew, as it is said, what was in men. He knew that was just personal sense trying to follow him and making a big do about his personality. Okay, that was the... Yeah, that is it. Huh?